Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
Kia ora, g'day and welcome to the History of Aotearoa New Zealand. Episode 123, Part 1. My Burb of the Century 2023. This podcast is recorded in Te Whanganui a Tara, on the rohe of Mua Upoko, Taranaki Whānui, Te Ati Awa and Ngāti Toa Rangatira. We are generously supported by our amazing patrons. If you want to support Hans, go to patreon.com/historyaotearoa. It is nearly the end of another year, which means here in Aotearoa, it is time for the most important election of the political calendar. The Bird of the Year. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you'll know what this is about. But for those that don't, Bird of the Year is an annual vote run by the conservation organisation Forest and Bird. It's quite a contentious vote, but thankfully you don't have to pick just one. You get to rank your top 5 birds from the selection offered. And even better, it's an online vote, so even if you're not based in New Zealand, you can still have your say. And at the end, whichever bird gets the most votes is given the illustrious title of Bird of the Year. This time around, though, it is an extra special election. Forest and Bird was founded in 1923, making this year their 100th birthday. Hooray! To celebrate, they're calling Bird of the Year the Bird of the Century, and added a few more contenders, all of whom are extinct. Some of them you've probably heard of, like the huia, and others you probably haven't. I've chosen not one, but two of these lesser-known extinct birds to teach you about. And in addition to two birds, we're going to have two hosts. I thought it might be good to bring in some extra scientific knowledge, if you will. So, I invited my partner, Lily, to come on and add their insights into avians and ecology as well. I've split our chat into two episodes with one bird in each, both releasing on the same day. You're currently listening to part one, so when you finish this episode, there's another already available waiting for you. Enjoy! Kia ora, Lily. Thank you for coming on to talk about... Lily's waving, but you can't see that. but do you want to talk about why... Because you've been on a Patreon episode before, but this is actually going to go out on the main feed.
Yeah, I also was... I don't think I was even done with school the last time I was on this.
No, I so don't think you were.
I'm kind of glad that that went out to a smaller group of people, because I'm sure if I went back and listened to it, I'd be like, what is this kid talking about? What a fool. What an ignoramus.
So do you want to, I guess, because I've brought you on the Bird of the Year episode, Bird of the Century
Whoa.
It is this year, do you want to talk about your, I guess, your qualifications. Why have I brought you on in particular?
Well, other than the fact that I live in your house with you.
Yeah, that you're my partner and you're easy for me to access. But it's not because of that necessarily. You do actually have qualifications and knowledge that is relevant.
Yeah, so I'm an ecologist, which, if you're not familiar with that, that is essentially the study of ecosystems. So it's a subset of biology. I studied mostly forest systems, so focused on trees and woody vegetation back in Tennessee in the United States. And then I worked on some bird stuff for a while, breeding birds and things. I've studied a fair amount of reptile and amphibian and bird taxonomy and evolution and anatomy and things like that. And I did my master's at the Victoria University of Wellington on spotted skinks and just general conservation ecology 2 years ago now. And yeah, now I work as an ecologist. So a lot of my job is going out and looking at ecosystems and figuring out what threats they face and how to manage those.
Yeah. So you're actually a ecology person. You know lots of things about a variety of native species that I don't know.
Mm. I'm trying to catch up. You know, I've been in New Zealand for... it'll be 4 years in January, so it's been a bit of a catch-up to start over on all sorts of species that I've never encountered before, and most of the species I have encountered before simply are not here, so
yes.
There's been a bit of a learning curve, but I'm doing my best.
Yeah. So today we're going to talk about, I'm going to somewhat teach you about bird. You know a lot of stuff that I don't.
What the birds are is going to be a surprise, so this is a pop quiz for me.
Okay, sure. We have talked about them, so...
I don't remember.
Okay.
ADHD coming in hot.
So this is going to be... I don't know yet whether I'm going to split the episodes up or keep them all as one big one.
Okay.
But we are going to talk about two birds, ultimately. Mm. The first one we're going to talk about is the Matuhituhi, also called the Tom Thumb bird. I put that in there because I thought that was fun.
I'm going to go ahead and guess it's something in Acanthaceae because those are all really tiny.
Maybe. I have it written down here, but okay. I don't know how that translates to how it sounds.
Okay.
it is the bush wren.
Yes, that is in Acanthaceae. They're related to Titipunamu.
Yes, so we will get into that a bit as well. So it's Xenicus longippes.
Mm-hmm.
Longippes?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the species anyway. There's actually, I believe it's three different species or subspecies mm-hmm. depending on who you ask and how they classify mm-hmm. it.
The trouble with Latin is a dead language, so everyone, you can ask six different specialists and get six different ways to say it, probably.
Exactly. As I will have mentioned at the top of this episode, Bird of the Year is now Bird of the Century this year because Forest and Bird are 100 years old this year. And so because of that, they've opened up some of the categories to birds that are no longer around, that are extinct. So in past episodes of this, we've talked about the New Zealand threat classification of the variety of birds. So things like... or what are they? There's nationally, critically endangered, nationally...
So it goes not threatened, at risk, naturally uncommon, at risk, relict, at risk, recovering, at risk, declining, threatened, nationally vulnerable, threatened, nationally endangered, threatened, nationally critical, and then extinct.
Yeah, so that last one is what both of these birds that we're going to talk about are. These are extinct, they're no longer around, which is... really actually quite depressing because when I was researching them, I was like, man, this is really cool. These things are really interesting. Mm. And then you realize you're never going to mm-hmm. see these ever again. But yeah, so in terms of the NZTCS, these guys are extinct. So they're not around anymore.
There is some wiggle room. I mean, these guys they're gone, but there is some wiggle room globally. Sometimes things will be extinct in the wild before they cease to exist completely.
Mm.
So there may be only some left in captivity. That was the case with the Tasmanian tiger. There's also functionally extinct. So the kakapo is a little bit in that category.
Mm.
Not formally, I don't think, but there's so few of them that they no longer meaningfully contribute to the function of an ecosystem. And that's when we talk about things like extinction debt. Like, they're still around, but they're on their way out.
as part of that, these are also endemic to New Zealand. So there's no other way that these say locally extinct in New Zealand. If they're extinct in New Zealand, they're extinct everywhere. There's none left at all. So we're going to go through, if you've listened to these sorts of episodes in the past, you know vaguely the sort of things that we talk about. What do they look like? What do they sound like? What do they eat? That sort of stuff. But some of the categories we're going to change, or I have changed slightly, because, of course, we can't really talk about, say, the threats and research that is being done on these animals, because in theory they don't really have any threats anymore, and there isn't really any research being done into them in terms of, you know, trying to learn more about them, because that's quite severely limited in what we can actually learn.
I will say, though, with threats, most of the things that have gone extinct in New Zealand have a lot of commonalities.
Absolutely. And this is the same
for
their
behavior, particularly reproductive behaviors, is usually the Achilles heel of these species.
Yeah. So it's the same. It's always a big theme. It's always the same things. So the reason that these guys went extinct is virtually the same as every other problem that
honestly
is going
with things
on.
Like birds in New Zealand, I feel like almost all of them, the ones that went extinct, is because they lay their eggs on the ground, like, or too close to the ground, you know. That's why Tiakea are not doing well as well.
Yep.
A lot of shorebirds, if you lay your eggs on the ground and you live on an island, bad
yep.
news when you get rats
yep.
showing up
yeah
globally throughout the Pacific. Yeah,
or you're stinky if you're kakapo
yeah
as well.
Yeah. Yeah, double whammy for those guys.
Yeah. So let's crack into what do they look like. As you mentioned earlier, they are related to Titiponamu, the rifleman. So they look, if you are aware of what those look like, it's pretty similar. So they're very, very small. They're about 9 centimeters in length, and they're 16 grams in weight. So very small. They have a short tail. Or say it had a short tail, and is rarely seen flying. They prefer to sort of perch and then jump, or sort of do short flights between various bits.
Something you'll notice with Titiponamu, and probably these guys had this as well, short, broad wings in the avian world are for achieving lift quickly but not covering distance.
Mm.
So it's more of a kind of whoa, get out of here strategy, or a hop
yep.
around strategy. You're not trying to cover any distance. It's the opposite of something like seabirds with the long thin wings that are bad at taking off but good at staying in the air for a long time.
Yeah.
So you might be able to hop out of the way, but if you've got something in pursuit, you're not carrying any distance. you might get up into a tree and then have nowhere else to go.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So they have long feet and toes with olive green or brown on their head, which is sometimes called a brown cap as well, which is kind of fun. And they also have a bit of olive green on their back as well. They have white sort of eyebrows. You know, they're not eyebrows, but their plumage around their eyebrow area is white, and they have a grey chest with a pale chin. And there's also some dull sort of yellow feathers on the flank.
They're faux leather feathers.
Feathers, yeah. Yeah. And there isn't a huge amount of difference between the male and the female. The female is a little bit more brown than the male, but otherwise they look pretty much the same.
Again, similar to Titiponamu.
Yeah, exactly. The plumage does change slightly depending on the species. So, for example, ones found in Stewart Island are a bit more variable in their appearance. So they had their eyebrow stripe is not as prominent, or it doesn't exist in certain individuals. And they can range more from green to brown, a bit more on the back, so the variation on the back is a bit.
The rock wren, which I think is in this same family as well,
yep,
and
it is
still extant, thankfully,
yep,
they have that cream eyebrow. So if you want to find a picture of the rock wren,
yep,
that's what that looks
very
like.
Very similar, yeah. And the North Island birds were also found to have blue bits on the sides of their necks and chest, and the yellow on their flank was a little bit brighter. So again, slightly dependent on sort of the species / subspecies. Not a huge amount of variation between the... Mm-hmm.
That blue is really interesting because that's a pretty complicated color for nature to produce.
Mm.
Typically that has to come from anthocyanins in the diet.
Mm.
So a lot of times if you have birds with blue on them, particularly if that's for males or part of breeding plumage. It's what's called an honest signal, which is to say they can only produce that impressive coloring if they've been eating well.
Yeah.
So that could have been.
Could have been something.
Sadly, we'll never know. But no, yeah, that's often how blue works in birds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as we've alluded to a few times already, there is three different subspecies of, or was three different subspecies of the bush wren, which was the North Island, South Island, and Steed's bush wren, which I don't know who Steed was.
What did he do?
Why he got a bush wren. but yeah, he got his own one, apparently. And in total, there are seven species in the New Zealand wren family, with the bush wren being the most ancient of these. So it's the oldest branch of the wren family.
A basal clade.
A basal clade, yes, but...
basal with an A, not an I.
No.
Not basal.
Not basal, no. Basal, yeah, as in base. The only surviving members of this family, as we mentioned earlier, are the rifleman, or the titiponamu, and the rock wren, or the piwowo. The rock wren being the more closely related of the two to the bush wren.
They're very poor flyers. They really hop around most of the time.
Yeah, so they're very similar in both appearance and behavior, apparently. Mm-hmm. So,
and they're not doing so hot. I don't know their status off the top of my head, but they're not pretty limited. They're an alpine species. South Island only, I'm like 99% sure.
Yeah, well, that's where most of the alpine stuff is, I guess, isn't it? So that would make sense.
Yeah.
Something I also normally do on these episodes is New Zealand Birds Online has, of course, recordings of the calls of all of these animals. However, in the case of the bush wren being extinct, we don't have that. It's not that actually this was impossible. This is actually the bush wren actually went extinct fairly recently, as we'll get to a bit later. But for some reason, I guess no recordings.
Well, the two guys that are alive still in this family, they are not singers per se. They vocalize really just to signal and communicate to each other. And I don't know what the rock wren sounds like, but the titiponamu, people over about 45 and 50 usually cannot hear it anymore.
Yeah,
they're so
tiny,
their calls are so high-pitched. It's really just like kind of like a almost noise.
Yeah.
So there's not necessarily a lot to record, even if you have the opportunity. They don't sing in the way that we would expect some birds to.
Yeah, because I remember we were in, I think it was in Zealandia, and you could hear them as we were walking down a path. And I had to really concentrate to hear them, but you picked up on it a lot quicker than I did.
That's a combination of practice and just different hearing, I think.
Well, yeah, my hearing's munted, so. Yeah.
None of your senses are stellar, I'll be honest.
No, they're not. No, too much listening to loud music, that one apparently. So yeah, but we've got people who have obviously have heard these calls and described them, which is not really, when you read
There's
people.
There's a poetic tragedy to that.
Yeah. But also it's really hard to describe bird calls.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that that New Zealand Birds Online described it was they have a subdued trill, a fast rasp, or a loud quote-unquote seep, sometimes made rapidly, repeated rapidly, sorry.
That seep, that sounds more like what the titiponamu does to me.
Yeah.
The rasping, a lot of small birds that travel in mixed flocks do a version of psh, 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 psh in some way. That's kind of like a interspecies, hey, come check this out sort of thing they'll do if they, you know, see a predator coming. Or sometimes if you're walking through the bush, particularly if you're in North America or Europe, you may cause a ruckus and hear a lot of psh, 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 psh as birds come to kind of check you out and things. So it may be something like that.
Yep. Yeah, could be. They do have, well, it says here, they do have a loud cheep as an alarm call. And mated pairs would make soft calls back and forth to each other as well. So that's a lot of what seems to be a lot of what they were doing, is they would hang out in these mated pairs and then call to each other, which to me also sound quite similar to the matata. The fern bird does a lot of that as well. They will call back to each other quite often.
The titiponamu, I don't have a strong sense of how much time they spend together outside of breeding season. I think they're more loosely organized. but the pairs really stick together during breeding season. There's a lot of nuptial feeding and courtship feeding, which is when the male brings snacks to the female, and they work quite closely together on the nest and the chicks and everything. And they're really just, yeah, constantly beep, beep, beep at each other.
Yeah. What a great segue to what do they eat, which Tizi Pounamu, I'm pretty sure it's the same. I would assume Rock Green is also the same, is they're all insectivores.
Yeah, tiny bugs.
Tiny bugs, yeah. So moths, flies, beetles, spiders, lots of different larvae of all of those animals as well. And they do a lot of... the way that they find all these things is by probing crevices in trees and stuff, and also gleaning from them.
I was about to say, I was going to guess that they glean.
Which I was going to ask you, do you want to explain a bit about what that actually is and what that means?
It's not far off what you said about kind of probing crevices, but a lot of times there are many birds all over the world that are very small and kind of acrobatic, and they basically just use a tree as a 3D jungle gym obstacle course, and they're looking for teeny tiny bugs, like little mites and ants and little bitty things like that, on the undersides of branches and amongst leaves and stuff. So they sort of just velcro themselves onto the tree and just tootle around, going every which way looking for teeny tiny snacks, which is fun. So it's sort of just, I guess, the bird version of grazing almost, where they're just covering an area and picking up what they can find.
Yeah, so that's so I thought that was quite cool. It's just crawling around.
Yeah, all it's over fun to watch. And, the brown creeper, both the one in New Zealand, which I think is PPP.
I think so. Yeah,
and the completely unrelated but vaguely similar looking brown creeper in North America. They're nuthatches. If you're familiar with those, they do the same thing where they just all over the place.
Yeah,
very entertaining to watch.
Nice. So where do they live? Well, as you can probably guess from at least two of the subspecies, they live in the North and South Islands, as you might expect, along with Carpety Island, Stewart Island, and the three South Cape Islands, which are actually just off the coast of Rakiura, Stewart Island on the southwestern coast there as well. And saying that, there's not many reported sightings in the North Island. Mostly where they were found were in Te Uruwera on the east coast, Taupō in the central area of the North Island, and the Rimutakas, which are sort of southern central-ish.
Those are kind of just some of the remaining strongholds of extensive forest.
Yeah, it's so not
they,
necessarily...
They may have had a much wider distribution before human arrival, before people started writing down where they were.
Yeah, exactly. So that's not necessarily indicative of their actual range, more probably indicative of those areas, as you say, are some of the more well-protected and older forests in New Zealand that are still around. So kind of makes sense that they're probably found in those areas.
There's a lot of things that are doing pretty well in the Rimutakas that are almost gone from the rest of the North Island.
Yeah. So within those areas, the kind of habitat that they were hanging out in was forest and scrub in mountainous areas. So they like it quite hilly. Most sightings recorded in the South Island were actually in beech forest and shrubland in subalpine areas, as well as podocarp forest in Fiordland and Stewart Island, which I guess is all kind of makes sense for, again, the kind of areas that they were being found in. In terms of, I guess normally we'd talk about how many individuals are left in terms of their population. They're extinct, so there's zero. The last recorded sighting was at Lake Waikare Moana, which I believe is also sort of on the east coast of the North Island, and that was in 1955. There was another in Milford Sound in 1965. There was another in Arthur's Pass the year after that in 1966, and then another near Nelson in 1968. In terms of their breeding, they made spherical nests that had a hole near the top, so you could get in, which I thought was kind of fun.
That's fun. Where did they build them?
I don't know if I wrote that down. Oh, nests were often located in damp areas. I wrote that down.
Sorry,
I did write it down, but you...
Well, Tizi Pounamu are cavity nesters, but you don't... That doesn't sound like something you'd build in a cavity.
You'd be wrong.
Did they build in? Because I know some birds, like Tiake, one of the things they'll build a nest in, and I think Kakariki will do this as well, when a tree fern is fallen over and there's just the stump left and it's hollow, there are birds that like to nest in those.
Yeah, so that's pretty much what it is, yeah. Nests would be hidden in the holes of trees or logs, or could actually be within tree roots or clumps of ferns. Mm. But otherwise, in general, they would be quite close to the ground.
Yep.
So again, to what you were saying earlier. Yep.
Just like DAK.
Yep, if they nest close to the ground, it's not super good when you're trying to combat things like rats or stoats or that kind of stuff. But I thought that was quite cool because Titi Ponamu don't really do that, do they? They just go into...
I don't super know what the interior looks like, but they find really tight little crevices that, I mean, these are birds the size of a ping pong ball and they still have to squeeze in there. But I'm not sure what kind of system they build on the inside. A lot of cavity nesters basically just build up a bed of fluff.
Yeah.
Rather than making any sort of structure, they really just kind of build a floor up. So that's very interesting that they build a structure in a hollow.
Yeah. So they do sort of build with fluff. They use feathers from other birds, as well as fern roots and moss and leaves and all that sort of stuff. But what I thought was quite interesting is that they replace the feathers every time it rains, which I'm not really, I guess, because they just get wet and they're not as good
anymore. If they're using down does not keep anything warm. Because the way down works is by holding air between the phylloplumes, that's it.
The feathery bits.
The fluffies, yeah. So, like, there's the main stem of the feather, and then there's the little bitties, the little floofs off the side. Those are phylloplumes.
Mm.
And if those get wet, they stick together, and there's no more air to be held. So they go flat, and they don't keep you warm.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense.
Which is also why you should not wear your down coats in the rain. Don't do it.
Don't do it. Don't wear your puffer jackets in the rain. They're not designed for that.
No. And a good raincoat is cheaper than a puffer jacket.
That is true. I can't say that I've looked into the price of puffer jackets in over a decade.
A good raincoat is cheaper than a down coat.
Anyway.
So off topic, just a weird personal vendetta of mine.
So we don't know too much about their eggs and that sort of thing, but we do know that two or three eggs would be laid at the end of the year in November or December. And the care of those chicks would then be shared between the parents. Which again, I think is quite similar to Titi Ponamu as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In terms of random behavior, they're often found in pairs or small family groups. Mm. So the parents and the children.
Mm-hmm. Again, like Titi Ponamu, the offspring will usually stay and sometimes they'll even stick around to help raise the next clutch, which is fun.
Yeah. So they're very territorial during breeding season. And on the mainland, they were reported to feed in the branches of trees, whereas Titi Ponamu tend to feed around the trunks, apparently. So instead of on the trunks, they were feeding in the branches. Mm. I don't really know why that is. That might be that interesting sort of niche thing.
Yeah.
That, you know, I don't know how you got taught it in school, but the way that we got taught it in school was with harakeke, with the notches and the holes, in terms of one species of caterpillar would eat the leaves by eating on the edges, and another species of caterpillar would scrape a hole through the middle. And so because of that, their niches are different and therefore they're not competing with each other.
I'm pretty sure the term is niche stratification.
Sure.
But I'm not that... I may be inventing that. Sure.
We could just say.
But yeah, that is common, especially ecosystems that are focused around large trees.
Mm.
Like you get that with redwoods and things, is you'll have different birds specialize gleaning in different areas or feeding in different areas of the tree so that they're not competing with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
So back in the day when these could have been around at the same time as Titi Ponamu, they could have... coexisted. Now whether or not they would have allowed that in breeding season, I don't know, because Titi Ponamu are also very spicy in breeding season and they will chase other things away.
Yeah, it's just that with two species that are extremely similar, they eat the same things, they're hanging out in the same areas, they're using the same places to kind of set up nests and things, generally you wouldn't think that those would really coexist in the same area all that well.
I guess we're sort of limited on our information about what the range of the bush wren was
true.
Was like, because if the last places they existed were alpine areas, that could just be a function of where they were able to hold out.
Mm.
But if historically that's where they lived, I don't think Titiponamu go really into alpine areas.
Mm. Yeah, but I'm not sure.
I would not put money on that.
Yeah.
I don't think they go high up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it may have been a geographic stratification way.
Potentially, yeah.
Allopatric rather than sympatric.
Yes, I do remember that from high school biology. Mm-hmm. So on islands around Rakiura, they would stick to low, dense vegetation and spend a lot of time on the ground, apparently even entering the burrows of petrels, which I thought was
everybody's
kind of
interesting. Everybody's in those petrel burrows.
Yeah.
The gang's all here. Got everybody in there.
Because I think Tuatara also have been found
and
in there.
And some species of skinks will go into TT burrows.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's, we're all just hanging out.
That is the thing you see commonly globally, though, is if there is an ecosystem where something goes to the trouble of digging holes or creating a cavity, other things are very keen to jump on that opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think kiwi have been found in burrows with Tuatara as well. Mm. And a few other things, probably.
Yeah, toots will dig their own burrow, but, like, why would you if you don't have to?
If the hole's already there, made by a bigger animal. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, they would make short, direct flights between branches, being very swift and energetic. While they were doing this, they would also often bob when they landed, either with their whole body or just with their head, which I thought was very funny.
That's delightful. That is absolutely delightful. There's a bird called the American Dipper that is called the Dipper partly because it's the only passerine that is semi-aquatic. They dip into the water, and they also bob up and down. So
that's fun.
I would recommend looking it up on YouTube. Absolutely. They're very funny, very funny birds.
Amazing. Let's bring the mood down. Let's talk about... let's talk about the bush wren's extinction.
Mm.
So instead of talking about the threats and things, let's talk about how and why it went extinct. Because, as we said earlier, it's a pretty big theme. If you've listened to other episodes like this, you already know what the theme is. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about it anyway. Because one interesting thing about the bush wren is that it was the last endemic bird in Aotearoa to go extinct.
Isn't the most recent?
Yes,
okay.
The most recent.
There will probably be more, unfortunately.
There is also a slight brackets or caveat that it depends on how you count the South Island kōkako, the kōka. It depends on how you count that.
Controversy.
Because if you do count that, then that was the last one that went extinct, depending on... Because it's currently classed as being data deficient, not extinct. Mm. So technically... The South Island kōkako is not extinct.
Mm-hmm.
However, that very much depends on who you ask.
Well, we can't confidently say whether or not it is extinct.
No, but I've talked to people that say, yeah, they're full of it and it definitely is extinct.
I always feel about things like that, that isn't it wonderful there's still a little bit of wilderness left where something like that could be... Like, the fact that it isn't completely off the table gives me a tiny glimmer of hope. Even if they are extinct, at least there's some places out there that could still have them, because I'm sure a lot of other things are being protected in those places where they are speculated to be.
Yeah. So I think I've told you this story before, but I don't think I've talked about it on the podcast, so I'm going to talk about it again.
Yeah.
Is one of my workmates went down to the West Coast, and he was talking to some dock people, Department of Conservation people down there, and they would talk about how people would hear South Island kōkako in those areas on the West Coast, and people would come back and say, I found it, I heard it, it's definitely there. And they're like 99% sure there's none in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But the going theory is apparently that the tui are replicating the calls from the kōkako, which is pretty common that tui do that. I'm actually pretty sure I heard a tiaki not far around the corner from where we're living yesterday.
It was definitely
a tui.
I've heard that same bird.
Really?
Because one day I like stood up off the couch and was like, what? Then realized, I was like, no, it's not quite right. It's the right melody, but the wrong voice.
Yeah. And I had the same thing when I was on holiday in Palmerston North. Mm. I also heard a tiaki, and I asked a local conservation guy, and he said, Maybe, but like it's really unlikely. It's more likely that Atui has just copied a Teiki mm-hmm. and come down from where those are hanging out.
There was something else when we were in at Iroka Nui, I think it was. I followed a bird around for about 15, 20 minutes thinking it was a kakariki. And it was a Tui the whole time, and I was really mad.
So Tui are really good at mimicking other species. But I think what they thought, these guys on the West Coast thought had happened is, because of course if there's no kōkako around, the Tui must have passed down through the generations this call to their offspring. And so although that species is no longer around anymore, the Tui are still replicating it because they're culturally passing that information on to their offspring, which I thought that was pretty cool.
There's some really amazing science that has been done on how birds learn songs, particularly birds that mimic things. Great deep dive to take. There's a book called by Tim Burkhead that I cannot remember the name of, but it's by Tim Burkhead, and there's a flamingo on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I highly recommend if you'd like to read a general overview about how incredible birds are book. That's it's like, what is it like to be a bird or something like that?
Sure.
Yeah.
I might find it and then put it in the description.
Please
so
do,
that
because I'm annoyed that I can't remember the title.
So yeah, so that's what they think was going on down there. No one's ever confirmed it. So South Island kōkako technically currently classed as data deficient. But if you do count them as extinct, the last confirmed sighting was in 1967. That's the last time that they absolutely 100% know that it was definitely a kōkako. But there was a sighting in 2007 that was accepted as being the last one by the Department of Conservation. So the Department
of the kōkako?
The South Island kōkako in 2007.
Really?
That was the last time that... so that one was...
Super didn't know that.
Yeah, so that was a bit of contention, apparently. So that was when they were a bit like, nah, we don't think it is. But later, that doc classified that as a confirmed sighting.
Oh, that changes everything. No, here I was thinking that it hadn't been seen in like 50 years.
No.
That very much changes my opinion on the matter. Yeah, that's super possible then. Huh.
Yeah.
So wowee.
So they might still be around.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's much more feasible.
No one's had a confirmed sighting.
I mean, there's still people seeing Tasmanian tigers and stuff, you know, so.
That's true, yeah. But they've all turned out to be not true.
Yeah,
not
your uncle's actual. Ugly dog or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the bush wren went, or the last confirmed, 100% confirmed sighting was in 1972. So about 50 years ago, or just over 50 years ago now. And all three species likely went extinct roughly within 20 years of each other. So although we obviously don't know exactly when they went extinct, it would have been around 1972.
Were these species or subspecies?
Subspecies,
okay.
Yeah. So ship rats in particular is what got them when they when the rats got down to the South Cape Islands. They wiped them out pretty quickly in 1964. It was pretty insane. And actually what ended up happening was the Wildlife Service, which was the precursor to DOC, when they found out that the rats had made it to the South Cape Islands, launched a desperate attempt to move... to capture and then move some of the bush wrens. So they managed to get six of them and then move them from one of the islands and then move them to a different, slightly different island nearby. And that sort of did work for a bit.
Were the rats eating the adults or just the eggs and chicks?
I don't know if they actually know that. I couldn't find that information.
Sometimes you get this, again, extinction debt where... you'll still see the adults flying around and maybe think they're okay. But if they're failing to reproduce every year, there's going to be that time lag where however long the adults live, you know, 6 years or something like that for a bird that size probably, they'll seem fine and then they'll all just disappear.
Disappear overnight kind of thing, yeah. So they were taken from Big South Cape Island, Tokihipa, to Kaimohu Island in 1964. And then Kaimohu Island is where they were last seen in 1972, and no one's ever seen them since, or at least confirmed sightings.
Yeah, see, like that on an island, it's like there's a limited amount of space where they could be hiding.
Yeah. So we know the Stewart Island species in particular survived until at least 1951, but that was likely taken out by feral cats, that one. And we also know that all three species of rat, the Kiore, which is the Pacific rat, the Norway and the ship's rats, were likely what caused the populations to decline on the mainland, with stoats also not being not hugely contributing, but also not really helping the matter either. So it was mainly the rats is what did these guys in. So there's probably not a huge, you know, as you say, there's not a lot of room that these guys could be potentially living in terms of, like, you know, the islands are quite limited in their size. So if we were going to find them on those islands, we probably would have found them by now.
And that kind of feeding behavior, assuming it's somewhat similar to the Titipunamu, they cover a lot of ground relative to their body size. They have a decent territory. It's not like a Tuatara where it might sit in the same spot for 6 months.
Yeah.
So if they're out there and people are looking for them, you would expect them to encounter them.
Yeah. I think, though, on the counter side of that, species like Kakapo and Takahe were thought to be extinct for over 5 decades.
But
they're huge.
Yes, but they yeah, they're not like up in the trees flitting around and going peep-peep all day either.
That's true. And I guess they they're more likely to be, at least the adults are more likely to fend for themselves a lot easier than, you know, a tiny bush wren if it comes up against a rat or something like that, right?
I don't know, we've talked about how spicy stoats are. Like mustelids can take things down that are much, much, much bigger than them.
That's true. That is true. So
if
yeah,
if a stoat can take out a kiwi, I'm sure it can take out a takahe.
That's true. Yeah, so probably not a huge amount of hope that these guys are still around, unfortunately. But again, it's all the same culprits that we've seen before. Mostly leaning on rats this time. And that's basically all that we know about bush wrens, unfortunately. Because, again, they're extinct. There's not a huge amount that we can learn about them anymore.
Yep. Millions of years of evolution gone.
Just gone.
Are there study skins of them around?
I don't know. I couldn't see any pictures of any. So actually, I do not know.
We should look that up on Te Papa's website. If anyone would have one, they would.
They would, yeah. Mm. Or our old friends, the British Museum.
God damn it. Get your own tiny birds.
Thanks again to my partner, Lily, for coming on and sharing their knowledge. If you want to vote in Bird of the Century, voting opens on the 30th of October and closes on the 12th of November. I've put a link to the Bird of the Century voting page in the show notes. And as I mentioned at the top of the episode, you don't need to live in New Zealand to vote. You just need a valid email address. You get to rank 5 different birds, so get out there and let your voice be heard. Remember, this is part 1 of our Bird of the Century episodes. So if you want more bird facts, check out the other episode next to this one. If you want to send me feedback, ask a question, suggest a topic, or just have a chinwag, you can find my email and social media on historyaotearoa.com. Aotearoa spelt A-O-T-E-A-R-O-A. You can also find helpful resources there, like transcripts and sources. You can help support Hans through Patreon, buying merch, or giving us a review. It means a lot, and help spread the story of Aotearoa New Zealand. As always, haere tū atu, hoki tū mai. See you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.